Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Kimberly Atkins in for David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. President Trump told ABC's George Stephanopoulos that there's nothing wrong with accepting campaign dirt on political opponents from foreign actors.
If somebody called from a country, Norway, we have information on your opponent. Oh, I think I'd want to hear it.
You want that kind of interference in our elections?
It's not an interference. They have information. I think I'd take it.
Two oil tankers attacked in the Gulf of Oman. The U.S. released a video purporting to show Iranians removing a mine after the explosion. Iran has disputed the accusations. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke yesterday, but offered no evidence to back up the claim of Iran's involvement.
Taken as a whole, these unprovoked attacks present a clear threat to international peace and security, a blatant assault on the freedom of navigation, and an unacceptable campaign of escalating tension by Iran.
President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden traded barbs, insults, and even name-calling on the campaign trail in Iowa.
Sleepy Joe.
The president is literally an existential threat to America.
And he said my name so many times that people couldn't stand it anymore.
4 years of Donald Trump will be viewed as an aberration.
Biden, who's a loser.
8 years will fundamentally change who we are as a nation.
Joe Biden is a dummy.
Join us. What do you make of President Trump saying he'll accept information from foreign powers? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With us from Des Moines, Iowa is Breanne Fonensteel, chief politics reporter for the Des Moines Register. Breanne, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us from Washington is John Harwood, editor-at-large for CNBC covering Washington. He's also the host of CNBC digital video series of the host of the CNBC digital video series Speakeasy with John Harwood. I'm not speaking easy today, John, but it's good to have you here.
Hey, Kimberly, it's great to hear you in the chair.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Kim, Breanne, and John.
So I want to start off talking about President Trump's comments about accepting foreign dirt on political opponents. First, he told ABC's George Stephanopoulos that he would accept that information. He seemed to backtrack a little bit today on that. John, what do you make of these statements from the president?
I think the president was expressing his true beliefs. He's somebody who isn't hindered by any particular scruples in his personal or business life. And he knows that Russia interfered to help him in 2016. He won in 2016. He presumably wants to win again in 2020. And I think the president, views everyone through the prism of whether they help him or hurt him, thinks that people offering him information would be trying to help him, and therefore that's good.
So let's take a look at what he said in that initial interview with ABC News' George Stephanopoulos when he said he'd accept that information from foreign powers.
If foreigners, if Russia, if China, if someone else offers you information on an opponent, should they accept it or should they call the FBI?
I think maybe you do both. I think you might want to listen. There's nothing wrong with listening. If somebody called from a country, Norway, we have information on your opponent. Oh, I think I'd want to hear it.
You want that kind of interference in our elections?
It's not an interference. They have information. I think I'd take it. If I thought there was something wrong, I'd go maybe to the FBI if I thought there was something wrong.
Now, the reaction on Capitol Hill from Republicans was immediately different. We heard folks like Senator Mitt Romney say that that was wrong. We also heard from Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. He's a strong defender of President Trump, but he criticized these remarks about accepting information from foreign powers.
That's not the right answer. If a foreign government comes to you as a public official and offers to help your campaign, giving you anything of value, whether it be money or information on your opponent, the right answer is no.
So, Breanne, there in Iowa, how is this landing as we're leading up to the 2020 election? Is this something that it's on voters' minds?
Well, I think this is certainly something that's on voters' minds. And here at the Register, we do a lot of polling. We just did a poll recently about whether Iowa Democrats who are likely to participate in the caucuses think that Congress should move forward with impeachment proceedings. And Iowans are somewhat split. About 48% say Congress should continue investigating. 42% say that Congress should move forward with impeachment. And so this was before the president's most recent comments. We've seen the presidential candidates kind of double down, those who have called for impeachment really double down and saying that that's important. So I think we're certainly going to see that play out when these candidates return to Iowa. And it's definitely on the minds of Iowa caucus goers. They're just a little bit split on what they think Congress should do about it.
And the head of the Federal Election Commission released a statement yesterday, an emphatic statement from Ellen Weintraub, who's the chairwoman of the FEC. She said, "Let me make something 100% clear to the American public and anyone running for office. It's illegal for any person to solicit, accept, or receive anything of value from a foreign national." Jack, what do you make of all this?
Well, even by the president's standards, this was a shocker. He has sort of pushed shamelessness to new frontiers. You know, there's that line of William Blake's, "If a fool persists in his folly, he be wise." We're still waiting for Trump to be wise. He doesn't seem to have learned anything from the controversy of the last 2 years. And if he were just alone, you could say, well, it's an aberration. But, you know, as Jamelle Bouie reminds us in today's Times, he's got a friend in the Senate. Mitch McConnell, that mortician of the Senate, is bottling up bills that would help America fight off foreign interference in our elections. Bills with bipartisan support. It's as if he doesn't care about the Russians interfering either, because, again, as John said, if it helped us win, it's right. That's a formula of nihilism, political nihilism, not of any sort of idea of the public good.
Mike is on the line calling from Miami, Oklahoma. Hi, Mike.
How's it going?
Good, good. What are your thoughts?
I think if there's information out there, the president should be able to obtain it. So if they're offering up information, he should be able to obtain it. If you take it to the FBI like he said he would, but he should be able to obtain any information that he can.
But what about, Mike, what about this idea that if it's valuable, that can be seen as violating the law, which protects people, foreigners, who may want to exert influence over the United States from offering anything of value?
If the tables were turned and maybe he had information on somebody in Norway, wouldn't you think they would want that information? That's my thoughts. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Mike. John, what do you think about that?
Well, that's an invitation to mischief by hostile governments and intelligence services. No, that is not the right answer. And if the tables were turned, I do not think Norway would wish for the CIA to be furnishing attack material for candidates in Norway. This is not something that routinely happens in American politics. Yes, opposition research is created, most of it from public documents that are available for researchers on both sides of the aisle. Mm. But when you talk about the involvement of powers that do not have the best interests of the United States at heart, that crosses a line legally and from the interests of the United States, foreign policy interests. Russia hacked those emails. They released them. They distorted them. They used social media to send distorted messages and try to inflame parts of the American population. Yeah. We've got enough inflammation on our own without the assistance of the KGB.
I want to move on to Donald Trump and Joe Biden trading barbs in Iowa. During a speech in Council Bluffs on Tuesday, President Trump talked about Joe Biden, who was visiting the state on the same day.
He makes his stance in Iowa once every 2 weeks, and then he mentions my name 74 times in one speech. I don't know. That reminds me of Crooked Hillary. She did the same thing.
During a campaign rally in Davenport on Tuesday, former vice president and 2020 presidential candidate Joe Biden criticized President Trump's behavior on the world stage, citing a series of events from last week while the president was in England for a state visit and France to commemorate the 75th anniversary of D-Day.
He gets up in the middle of the night while he's at Normandy, and he tweets an attack on Bette Midler. The mayor of London, because he's Muslim. The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, who's there with him in Normandy. A stunning display of childlessness that the whole world watched.
And he's referring, of course, to the commemoration of the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Breanne, Joe Biden has 23 at least other Democratic primary opponents to get through first, but was it smart of him to focus on Donald Trump to make this look already like a general election race?
Well, we've seen Joe Biden do this from the very beginning. From the day that he launched his campaign, he's really positioned himself as the person who can help this country rise above what he says Donald Trump has brought us to. And so he's really focusing on, you know, being kind of this bigger person almost. And so he has the benefit, of course, of leading in the polls here in Iowa and nationally. He is the front runner at this point. And so he's really made great efforts to kind of stay out of the primary fray and position himself as the best person to take on Donald Trump. And this plays into what a lot of Democrats are telling us on the ground, that they want someone who can win, that that's the most important thing to them this cycle. They want someone who can take on Donald Trump, who can potentially win back a lot of these Democrats and working class blue collar areas that flipped to support him in 2016. Mm. And a lot of people see Joe Biden as that person. And so he's really leaning into it.
All right. We're going to hit the pause button here, but we'll come back. We'll talk about Iran, the census, and more top stories from this week. You can join the conversation. Do you worry that the U.S. and Iran are on a collision course? What do you make of Sarah Sanders leaving the White House? I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're talking about this week's top stories, including two women in President Trump's White House, one who is leaving and one who is staying, despite recommendations from a federal agency. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the recommendation that Kellyanne Conway should leave her post? And what about the legacy of Sarah Sanders as she leaves the press secretary post behind? You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm joined by a great panel of guests. Breanne Fonensteel is the chief politics reporter for the Des Moines Register. John Harwood is editor-at-large for CNBC covering Washington. And On Point News analyst Jack Beatty is here with us, too. Now, I want to turn back to President Trump and Joe Biden going after each other in Iowa, a very big, important first early primary state. John, is it a mistake for President Trump at this point to take Joe Biden's bait? I mean, the more he talks about Joe Biden, the more he elevates him, right?
He does. It is not necessarily clear that Joe Biden would be the strongest general election candidate. So in that respect, it's possible that elevating Joe Biden could help the president. But the fundamental point is that I don't think President Trump does much calculating. He's an impulsive person. He reacts to immediate stimulus around him. He sees that Joe Biden is leading the Democratic race and he can't resist going after him. Nancy Pelosi is a foil who's in his face, and so he's going to comment and rap her. This is somebody who is lives in the moment, doesn't think – I don't think he plays 3D chess or 4D chess or 5D chess. Mm. I think he reacts to what people say about him on television and what people say about him on Capitol Hill, and not all that strategic, I don't think.
Let's go back to the phone. Stephen is calling from Clearwater, Florida. Hi there, Stephen.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, I was wondering, you know, I hear that we're using the terms that they're trading barbs, and I appreciate the way of trying to describe that. But I'm somewhat frustrated. I have to be honest. I think that we've got almost a kind of false equivalence setting it up. My sense is that, you know, you hear Donald Trump talking about how he calls names. He is spurious, as your guest suggested. He's simply impulsive in responding. But, you know, Joe Biden is bringing up significant observations and you know, years and years of working within the within our government, you know, solving problems and working across the aisle. And now we've got. I think that's really my point. Is that I'd like to prevent, you know, kind of a, or try to put my voice in and prevent the false equivalence nature of our discussions, if that's possible.
I appreciate the call, Stephen. Jack, I want to turn to you to respond to that, and also whether Joe Biden should be going after Trump in this way. I mean, would it be better for him to focus on the issues, the kitchen table issues that other candidates like Elizabeth Warren have been focusing on?
Well, someone who was at his rally, quoted in the Times, pretty much said that. She said, "I wish he would talk less about Trump. We're Democrats. We know why we don't like Trump." She wanted to hear more about the issues. And the president himself made that criticism and drew a comparison with Hillary. She says, you know, Hillary did the same thing. She said, I was a bad man. Didn't talk about the issues. That's true. She had no message and lost the election. So that is a real criticism, I think, of the vice president, or it's a danger. It's a potential danger that he could get carried away with this Trump as the menace. And then the second point the president made, which was nasty indeed, and it's a case of the pot calling the kettle black, was that, you know, Joe is past it, that he's, quote, weak mentally. And that's quite a thing for Mr. Trump to say. But again, Biden has given that some credence. In one speech in Iowa recently, this is some weeks ago, he used the word folks 61 times. You know, I like Fowler's modern English usage. He's got an article in there against what he calls elegant variations. Basically, that means stick with the noun you started with. But Joe, 61 times?
All
Kimberly,
right.
could I just add there?
Yeah, go ahead, Jack.
I don't disagree with anything that Jack said, but to take Stephen's point, I think Stephen is 100% correct. We in the news business, because of the conventions of reporting, get into formulations like trade barbs or, you know, the Biden-Trump feud. Those things aren't feuds. They're not trading barbs. There's a difference between somebody who says something that is not rooted in truth, that is juvenile, that's sort of plainly ridiculous, and things that are serious criticisms of somebody who, in fact, is shredding presidential norms, inviting foreign interference in elections. You know, there's a difference between night and day. There's a difference between true and false. And President Trump, the things that comes out of his mouth often are completely fanciful. And when people call him out, those are not the same things. They're fundamentally different things.
All right. I want to move on to Iran and the fallout from a tanker attack in the Gulf of Oman and a video purportedly showing Iranians removing a mine from one of those ships. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said definitively that Iran was behind the attacks of those two tankers, but he offered no evidence.
Iran is lashing out because the regime wants our successful maximum pressure campaign lifted. No economic sanctions entitle the Islamic Republic to attack innocent civilians, disrupt global oil markets, and engage in nuclear blackmail. The international community condemns Iran's assault on the freedom of navigation and the targeting of innocent civilians.
And that was right before the U.S. released a video purporting to show Iranians removing a mine after that explosion. And speaking to Fox and Friends this morning, President Trump said Iran was behind the attacks of those two oil tankers.
Well, Iran did do it, and you know they did it because you saw the boat. I guess one of the mines didn't explode, and it's probably got essentially Iran written all over it.
So I want to go first to you, John. What does this set up? It seems that the United States has some tough decisions to make about how it responds, especially given Iran's denials.
It's a very challenging situation. There's legitimate reason to be concerned about Iran's behavior. Iran is seeing the United States having pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. They are concerned about the tight alliance between the United States, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and they're looking for ways to assert themselves. And it's a dangerous situation. We've seen a spike in oil prices yesterday as a result of that. And I think, you know, one challenge for the administration is that people like John Bolton and Mike Pompeo seem to be spoiling for a fight. So that give some inherent vulnerability to their position. On the other hand, Iran is misbehaving. And how they end up dealing with that, responding to that, when you have to summon the credibility of the United States to justify the U.S. stance at a confrontation, that's hard for this administration to do. Mm. Don't know where that's going.
So one thing that this could impact, of course, is oil prices. That's a kitchen table issue, if ever there was one, Brianne. How might you expect that to play itself out in Iowa?
I think you're right that Iowa Democrats right now are really focused on the issues that are affecting them day to day, these kitchen table issues like health care, like education. But, you know, we're starting to see some Democrats start to talk more about foreign policy. I mean, the same day that Donald Trump and Joe Biden were in Iowa, Pete Buttigieg was giving, you know, a big policy speech about his foreign policy views. So I think Democrats are eager for someone to kind of look at these issues and bring a little bit of stability back to what they see in foreign policy. But I think you're exactly right that they're more focused on the things that are affecting them day to day.
Saeed is on the line from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call. I just want to draw our attention and look at this conflict through Iran's eyes. From the perspective of Iran, they are on a death spiral with the economic sanctions that are now levied against them. Look at how many different theaters that they're involved in, and that their involvement requires finance. Furthermore, their staying in power inside Iran requires the financing of the repressive instruments of repression. Without that, the people of Iran will displace their leadership. And so Iran has no choice but to engage in the type of asymmetric warfare that it is that it is engaging in. We are very vulnerable here because we cannot win that asymmetric warfare. The only, our only approach to defending ourselves, our forces in the theater, are going is going to have to be the escalation to a type of war that we can win.
So, what do you think that escalation should look like, Saeed?
The one thing that is not an option, Iran will not sit there and suffer through these economic sanctions and see its the regime fall. What we're seeing is that in what's happening with the tankers is just the beginning. They will do this sort of attack on our interests across the board. They have no choice.
Saeed, I want to get Jack's take on this. What do you think the White House response might be? We have John Bolton, who has the president's ear, who seems to be, very, very hawkish when it comes to Iran. What do you expect will happen here?
Yes, Bolton is locked and loaded, and he's been that way pretty much for years. So we don't really know. You know, the president, it's hard to say what the administration's policy is. This policy of maximum pressure, as Saeed said, seems to be leading to incidents short of war, at that kind of coercive diplomacy that is someone, Bill Burns, the former Deputy Secretary of State, says is more coercion than diplomacy. That forces the other guy's hand. On the other hand, the president says all we want from Iran is that they don't have nuclear weapons. That is not the Trump administration policy. That was the Obama administration policy. The Trump policy, as stated by, or at least the Pompeo-Bolton policy, is, basically we want regime change, a list of all sorts of things that they want Iran to do before that should be the basis of our negotiation with them. What is our policy? Is it to drift toward war? Is it just to stop them having a nuclear weapon? Well, then if someone reminds Mr. Trump that that's the Obama policy, he's liable to run from it. It's a confused and dangerous moment.
I want to turn to a story which in any other normal week probably would have led this, but it's like the fourth biggest thing that happened this week, which is Democrats in Congress voted to hold Attorney General William Barr and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross in contempt. Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a member of the House Oversight Committee, which held that vote. She spoke at a Wednesday hearing just hours after President Trump invoked executive privilege to block Congress from seeing many of the documents surrounding the U.S. Census question on citizenship subpoenaed from Barr and Ross.
No one wants to be in a position where we have to issue a subpoena. But today, because of the secretary and because of the attorney general's refusal to cooperate with a co-equal branch of government, we have no choice. This is about the rule of law. This is about the respect of our institutions, and this is about the power of all of us as a body, as the United States Congress, and the integrity of the government of the United States.
John, the congresswoman says Democrats had no choice, but where do they go from here? I mean, they do have a choice, right? We saw that the Judiciary Committee is still in ongoing discussions with the Justice Department to avoid a criminal contempt vote. Where is all of this going? And is this part of Speaker Pelosi's plan, as she says, to methodically go forward with this investigation?
I think it is. I think the Democratic majority is going to continue pressing on multiple fronts to an administration that has, in a blanket way, because the president says the Democratic majority is biased, refused to cooperate. Saying the Democratic majority is biased is not, in our system of government, a legitimate reason for not complying with lawful requests. And so you're going to see the Democrats repeatedly try to figure out resolutions where they can, but where they can't, go to the courts, try to be vindicated in the courts, see what the administration does then. If the administration continues to refuse and defies the courts, that will strengthen their argument for something tougher like impeachment proceedings. Nancy Pelosi wants to go slow. She does not want to endanger members of Congress in her majority who represent Trump-friendly districts. So she's trying not to appear to go too fast. I do think at the end of the day, Democrats are going to get to impeachment proceedings. What happens when those begin, I don't know. But I think that every act of defiance by the administration makes it more difficult for the Democratic majority to avoid what I think most of them believe is their obligation to do, even though it may involve some political risk.
Now, Brianne, I know there is this axiom that folks don't care about the Russia stuff. They care about these kitchen table issues we're talking about. I know when I go to different parts of the country, people do ask about the Mueller report. What are you hearing, the Mueller report and the ensuing congressional investigations? What do you hear there in Iowa?
So here in Iowa, when you go to a lot of these presidential campaign events, when people do have the chance to ask a question, right, you get one question. This is going to be the most important thing that you want to get from the person in front of you. And so people are asking about healthcare. They're asking about education. They're asking about climate change. And, you know, during the month of April, the Register had this project. We tracked every question that got asked at one of the events we covered. We tracked 300 some questions, and very few of them were related to impeachment or the Mueller report. But I think you are getting the sense among these Democrats, maybe even if they're not following every twist and turn of these investigations, of these issues, they are getting a sense that this is not normal, that they want a return to some kind of stability. And so we do pull on impeachment, and I think we'll be interested to see how that number moves as we move through this caucus process.
All right. Hold on to our guests. We will be coming right back discussing this week's top stories, things like Kellyanne Conway and Sarah Sanders' future after the White House, and also Jon Stewart's emotional plea for 9/11 workers on Capitol Hill. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're talking about the top stories from this week, from Jon Stewart on Capitol Hill to Big Poppy, the latest in what led to his shooting. You can join the conversation. What stories are moving your world this week? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are Brianne Fonensteel, chief politics reporter for the Des Moines Register, John Harwood, editor-at-large for CNBC covering Washington, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. So I want to get to President Trump's press secretary, Sarah Sanders. Yesterday, she announced that she would leave the White House at the end of the month. She addressed her departure during an event in the East Room.
In the meantime, I'm going to continue to be one of the most outspoken and loyal supporters of the president and his agenda. And I know he's going to have an incredible six more years and get a whole lot more done.
Now, President Trump tweeted and said at an event that he hopes Sarah Sanders runs for governor from Arkansas, the home state that she will be returning to. Let's go to the phones. Brian is calling from Montgomery, Alabama. Hi there, Brian.
Hi. I just want to make a comment about
Sarah Sanders. She spent, her time defending lies that the president told, and just really dancing around in circles and giving the public, convoluted information, to cover up lies, in essence. And I would just, you wonder, but you look at Arkansas, and I'm not familiar with Arkansas, but the president giving her a plug in advance, campaign plug in advance to run for governor there, and I think I may be straying away a little, but we really need the Electoral College to stay in place. I had to rethink that because the people are being really dumbed down. People are very vulnerable to lies and I'm not going to say fake news. I don't like that term, but, but they're really vulnerable to lies and it's like whoever has the most money to put stuff out or whatever,
Yeah, Brian, I appreciate your call. Jack, what do you think about this potential governor's run by Sarah Sanders, who has come under a tremendous amount of scrutiny for the fact that she has stood before members of the press and said things that members of the press know are not true?
Yes, I suppose she could plead her client. Mr. Trump has, according to the Washington Post, he's now at 10,000 false or misleading statements. So she could well say, well, I'm representing a man who lies, and therefore I lie. But she has really taken resistance to transparency to new depths. It's been, I think, 94 days since there's been a proper press briefing. She's acted, when she did do those briefings, more as a wall than as a communicator. In fact, there's a character in *Midsummer Night's Dream* called Wall, and with him, I bid adieu to her. He says, "Thus have I, Wall, my part discharged. So, and being done, this wall away must go. Goodbye, Sarah. You've done your part."
All right. Another close confidant in President Trump's White House, Kellyanne Conway, was also in the news this week. This morning, President Trump told Fox and Friends that he would not fire White House advisor Kellyanne Conway, even after the U.S. Office of Special Counsel recommend that she'd be removed for repeatedly violating the Hatch Act.
Well, I got briefed on it yesterday, and it looks to me like they're trying to take away her right of free speech, and that's just not fair.
The U.S. Office of Special Counsel said Conway was, quote, disparaging Democratic presidential candidates while speaking in her official capacity during television interviews and social media. Of course, she was admonished before for hawking Ivanka Trump's products during White House commentary to John. There's really no enforcement mechanism for this. The president seems to be standing by Conway. Do you think that'll be enough?
Yes, I think nothing else is going to happen. But I think the episode reflects, the president's comments reflect Kellyanne Conway's dismissive comments, when's the jail term going to start, reflect the fact that the administration doesn't really care what the law is. That's why, again, it gets back to the issues that Democrats are discussing in the Congress, which is, do we vindicate the rule of law? The administration, to go back to Sarah Sanders for a second, is trying to shut down information to the Congress and shut down information to the press. They don't have regular Pentagon briefings anymore. They don't, as Jack said, have White House briefings. This is not because the press is biased against the administration. It's because the facts as they exist are unflattering to the administration and they don't want to discuss them. That's the situation the country finds itself in.
Mark is on the line calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. Hi there, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And I agree completely with what your commentator just said. He's right on point. I mean, Kellyanne Conway's brazenness should be appalling, and it should be appalling not just to Democrats. It's a little frustrating. We keep hearing, what are Democrats going to do about impeachment, when it should be, what are all Americans going to be doing about impeachment, when you have a president who clearly doesn't care about the law, reflected in his Russian comments, Kellyanne Conway comments about when does the sentence start. I mean, one would think, especially Republicans are constantly, have always considered themselves the party of law and order, but it doesn't, law and neither law nor order matter as long as if it gets in the way of their keeping power. Mm-hmm. And that's a really dangerous situation that I think we're in now.
Thank you for your call, Mark. I want to go to Sean, who's calling from Columbia, Missouri. Hi, Sean.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a public school teacher, and I've been looking at this lack of accountability. And as a teacher, if you have rules in the classroom that you don't enforce, kids are not stupid, and currently our politicians aren't stupid. It's not being enforced, so they just keep taking advantage of it because no one's doing anything, and we need to have some accountability from somebody for all the action being done.
Hmm. I want to go to Breanne. Thank you for that call. I want to go to Breanne and ask, on the campaign trail, this idea that President Trump's administration is full of people who don't follow rules, that he doesn't follow the rules when it comes to things like foreign offered dirt on campaigns, that Kellyanne Conway is staying in place despite this really clear admonishment and recommendation that she not serve in the federal government at all. Are you getting that sense from the people that you talk to there?
Yeah, I think you're seeing this on the trail a lot. A lot of the candidates are pointing to these things regularly. I mean, every time they're in the state, there's some new example that they can point to say, look, this administration has taken the country to a place that is not normal. And they'll make their case for why they're the person best to correct that. But there is 100% a sense among Democrats here in Iowa that they want someone where they're not going to have to worry about these day-to-day things. They just want a little bit of stability. And I think that's why a lot of people, particularly around Joe Biden, are looking to him as someone who can almost reset things, who can take things back to a state of normalcy. They know what they're getting with Joe Biden. They trust him. They tell me when we're on the trail here. But they're also looking to a lot of these other candidates who can maybe look at some of the structural underlying issues that make government unaccountable to the people.
And Jack, what do you think about this on the Democratic side? I mean, going to Breanne's point, you have some folks who want to see the system completely shaken up and redone with some of the newer candidates, more progressive candidates, or you see people may want to go back to the time that they recognized before through Joe Biden. But at the same time, President Trump is just calling all of this presidential harassment. Whose favor do you think all this plays into?
Well, the president is going to paint himself the victim. That a throbbing grievance is his métier. That's his connection to the most impassioned part of his base. They're aggrieved, and he's aggrieved, and he's going to just play that right down to the end. And on the Democratic side, you know, people say there's all this talk about impeachment. And yet, if you look at it, Perry Bacon in the Politico this week did a chart showing his impeachment, 40% want it. And here are the various items of the Democratic agenda that impeachment could be in the way of, you know, election reform, gun stuff, stuff for education, on and on. Those are in the 60s, the 70s, the high 50s. Overwhelmingly, it seems, the public wants the Democrats to, you know, try to get their agenda through. Of course, with Mitch McConnell, they can't, but at least to put it on the board. And but there's this groundswell of you know, impeachment and the danger for them, not just of putting their vulnerable members, leaving them exposed, but of getting away from what the public, at least now, seems to want, which is kitchen table issues.
And if I could just add to that,
yeah, go ahead, John.
Kimberly, I don't actually think there is a Democratic agenda to put on the board. They are passing bills that are not going to become law. So the question of investigating the president, potentially impeaching the president, doesn't really have much to do with a Democratic agenda that is roadblocked in the Senate anyway. And the administration doesn't really have much of an agenda at this point, aside from trying to get this U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal approved, although the administration's own actions have made it more difficult for that to happen. So I do think it's a bit of a false choice between kitchen table issues and impeachment.
Okay, I want to get to a viral moment from this week when comedian and former Daily Show host Jon Stewart appeared before the House Judiciary Committee in a hearing to advocate for funding for medical care for 9/11 first responders.
As I sit here today, I can't help but think what an incredible metaphor this room is for the entire process that getting health care and benefits for 9/11 first responders has come to. Behind me, a filled room of 9/11 first responders, and in front of me, a nearly empty Congress.
Now, Stewart has appeared many times before Congress advocating for funding for health care for the 9/11 responders. It was later revealed after that video went viral that only two members of the subcommittee were actually absent. It was a subcommittee hearing, not a full hearing of the Judiciary Committee. John Harwood, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, there are a few members at many hearings in Congress all the time because multiple overlapping committees are meeting. I think the House was not really holding up that aid to first responders. Their challenges in the Senate. But I respect Jon Stewart's passion and his commitment on that issue, and the expression of it no doubt will light a fire under even people who are already on his side and some who may have been resisting what he wants done.
All right, Dave is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Time will not wait for these men. I was there the night after the buildings were attacked. I'm old enough to have watched, growing up in New York, the buildings being built. These men came from Brooklyn, from fire companies all over the city and outside the city, never giving a thought to their own safety. New York is America's city. They didn't come as New Yorkers. They came for America. Time won't wait, and Congress needs to act, and Congress should have been there. This is the most important thing, is like our veterans, to remember people who come when they're called.
And Jack, on that point, I mean, what do you think the lasting legacy is? We are almost two decades past 9/11, and we're still seeing this continuous fight over taking care of those who respond for us.
Yes, this is a legacy that's going to linger. But as Jon Stewart, I think, poignantly noted, time is the commodity, the thing that these people don't have. There was one man with him on the panel who I think had had more than 20 different chemotherapy treatments. So, and Stewart generalized it. He said, and we have to also talk about Americans in Iraq and Afghanistan who, you know, were around these burns, these great burns of, poisonous, noxious material. They have to be taken care of, too.
All right. And one final story from this week, that is of Red Sox former slugger David Ortiz, who was shot in the Dominican Republic. NBC News reporting today that three more people were arrested in connection with that shooting. That brings the total number of people up to nine. An apparent hit done for a total of $8,000 to be split among the assailants. But we don't really know that much more about it than that. John Harwood, stories like this, it's not politics, but it certainly resonated through the country. I'm a Red Sox fan, but even those who weren't were really transfixed by this.
David Ortiz is a beloved figure in Boston and elsewhere. Somebody, obviously, who has a big heart, great talent on the baseball field. And, of course, in that famous moment after the Boston Marathon bombings, he stood on the field and expressed the pride and the strength of Boston. And I think everyone around the country was hurting when they saw what happened. And everybody's quite thankful that he's getting very good medical care in Boston. And we hope he'll have a full recovery.
Yes, he was flown back to Boston from the Dominican Republic by the Red Sox to be treated here at Mass General Hospital. John Harwood, editor-at-large for CNBC, covering covering Washington. Thank you, as always, for joining us.
Thanks, Kimberly.
Breanne Fonensteel, Chief Politics Reporter for the Des Moines Register. So great to have you today. Thank you.
Thanks, Kimberly.
And On Point News Analyst Jack Beatty. As always, it's always good to talk to you, Jack. Have a great weekend.
My pleasure. Thank you, Kim.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.